needed to talk to someone. She needed Boyd. She needed to get back to work. She needed to sleep. Her heart sank deeper as the plane rose higher above the dark clouds, and she struggled with the sins she'd committed and the ones to which she'd practically succumbed. Would she ever be able to sleep again? Chapter 77. The boy looked like an unfinished sculpture, the man thought. Just like he himself. Weak, fragmented, incomplete. Here in St. Angela's, his nemesis. He'd spent his miserable childhood within this enclosure, and he'd grown, like ivy inhabiting a cracked concrete wall, wild and untethered. His soul darkened day by day as he became enshrined in his own world. Abuse and deceit engulfed him, but as the years passed, he learned to bury embryonic evil beneath the daily facade of normality. And now St. Angela's had once again resurrected the devil, exhumed the darkness, bringing him on this final journey. Back to where he had started. And he knew it would finish here. He kicked the boy lying on the ground, and when he moaned, he dragged him to his feet, pushed him up the steps and back to the room. He thrust him down on the mildewed floorboards, banged the door shut and locked it. Leaning against the worn timber, he breathed heavily. He had spared the boy, kept the demons at bay. But for how long? 30th of January, 1976. The four of them huddled together when they should have been running. The door swung open. Brian stood there, a white robe covering his body, his thin arm edged up the wall, his narrow fingers flicking on the light. Sally shielded her eyes against the brightness.
"Are you all right?"
she asked.
"No," Brian said. "I'm not all right. Neither are you. You're all to come down to the chapel. Father Conn orders you to come."
"Are you mad or what?"
Patrick asked, stepping in front of Sally. She wanted to tell him she was brave enough to stand up for herself, but didn't. Because she wasn't.
"I asked you a freaking question," Patrick said. "You've all to come with me," Brian said, his voice deadpan like his eyes.
To Sally he seemed a lot older, standing there in the doorway. She put her hand on his arm and felt bone beneath skin. He jumped, as if she had pinched him. He grasped her hand and pulled her out the door. She screamed, and Fitzy snapped out of whatever stupor he'd been in and dragged her back into the room with Brian still holding onto her. Sally fell and curled into a small heap at the boy's bare feet. Her body jerked with shivers.
"Please, Brian," she pleaded. "Let's all go back to bed and forget about this."
"You better come with me."
"He's waiting," Brian said, before he was pushed into the room.
From behind him, Father Conn, eyes as black as the night, reached in and yanked Sally to her feet. A scream tore from her throat as he dragged her out and down the stairs. She heard the shuffle of the boys as they followed. At the altar, he glared down at her, and she up at him. She knew every line on his face, every hair in his eyebrows, every whisker on his jaw, every tooth in his mouth, and she hated every inch of him.
"Bad girl," he said, his mouth snarling, teeth biting his bottom lip, fingers cutting into her arm.
"You're the one who turned me into a bad girl," Sally said.
The hint of bravado was a lie. At least the boys were there, standing like a band of warriors, though they hadn't a weapon between them. One of them shouted,
"You tell him, Sally."
Probably Patrick, she thought. The priest reached out his hand and seized the boy nearest to him. Fitzy, with his red hair gleaming in the candlelight. She could count the big flat freckles bridging his nose. And she saw fire burning flames in his eyes.
I'm not scared, you bully,
Fitzy said, squaring his shoulders. Sally wished he would keep his mouth shut. He was too young to be this brave, or was he plain silly? The priest surveyed him as if he was a prize fish. Sally whirled her head around in a frenzy. They had to get out of here, get help. But from whom? Not the nuns. Sure, everyone was afraid of Father Conn. He was the boss man. She didn't know what to do. She looked at Patrick. He appeared as hopeless as she was. Then, secluded in the flickering shadows behind the altar, she spotted the young priest with the ugly eyes. Standing there, in the dark alcove, doing nothing. Staring, rubbing his hands through his thick black hair, as if he did not know what to do either. His silent, passive presence was as terrifying as the maniac holding Fitzy. What were they to do? A scream from Fitzy drew her eye back to Father Conn. He was twisting the boy's arm up his back.
I will teach you to respect your elders. You were bad news from the day you entered these walls. And you will be bad news until the day you leave it, he said. You're nothing, Fitzy said bravely.
He looked very small. The priest tightened his hold with one hand and with the other plucked a candle from the altar. He held it to Fitzy's face. The flame flickered and danced, singeing his red hair black. Sally gagged at the smell.
Say you are sorry. You're nothing, only a bad bastard, and your mother is a prostitute.
Fitzy squirmed and wriggled. He couldn't break free of the stranglehold. Sally watched his helpless body convulsing and wished they could do something.
Anything.
They were as powerless as the stupid statues on the walls. Why didn't the other priest do something? She glanced over. He was still standing there, immobile. Father Conn threw the candle to the floor, kicked over his folded clothes, and picked up his long leather belt.
Brian, use the cord from your rope and tie this murdering brat's hands behind his back.
Sally saw a film of sweat on Brian's brow. She looked from Patrick to James, her eyes questioning. What's going on? They shook their heads vigorously.
Fitzy kicked, lashed out and bit.
The priest held fast. Brian did as he was commanded. Once bound, Fitzy was pushed by Father Conn to his knees before the altar.
You murdered that baby, didn't you?
The priest shouted.
The one we found under the apple tree.
Fitzy spat out a full mouth of phlegm.
I didn't, you lying bastard.
Tightening the belt round his hand, the priest drew out his arm and slashed the leather into Fitzy's face. The brass buckle cut into his cheek, and blood poured from the wound. The priest repeated his action, again and again. Sally scrunched her eyes behind her hands, then squinted through splayed fingers. When she couldn't bear it any longer, she screamed. And mustering up as much courage as she could, she ran at Father Conn. He turned, lashing at her with the leather. Patrick pulled her away and dragged her down the aisle. She thought of dashing back, but it was hopeless. She caught James by the hand, and the three of them scrambled up the stairs, shouting for help. Over her shoulder, Sally witnessed Brian holding Fitzy by the shoulders, while the lunatic brought the leather up. And down, again and again and again. As long as she lived, she would never forget the sound of leather tearing flesh and the boy's helpless screams. And the ugly young priest with the thick black hair standing in the corner, watching, doing nothing. As they fled towards the corridor, Sally heard a voice, loud and clear, behind them.
Stop!
The three of them turned in unison, coming face to face with the young priest, a halo of light from the crypt below, encircling him like a satanic fire. He walked up to them. Sally leaned into the boys' bodies. They were three, dissolved into one shadow.
Be quiet. We do not want to wake everyone up, do we?
The priest flashed a sly smile, his face colder than ice, eyes blacker than coal, voice sharper than a cut-throat razor.
You do not need to concern yourself with what you saw.
I will deal with it.
Do not utter this incident to anyone. Anyone, do you hear?
His voice a slow, severe whisper. The three nodded their heads like wooden puppets with an unseen force holding the strings.
If I ever hear of this again, well, you have seen what happened to that boy. I will not warn you a second time.
Now return to your beds. He melted back down the stairs. Sally and the boys looked at each other, eyes wide, brimming with tears.
What about Fitzy?
Sally whispered.
You heard what he said.
We have to forget about him,
Patrick said.
He's one unlucky fecker,
Jane said. He slid to the floor and fell against an iron radiator, his arms around his knees, shivering and sobbing. Sally sat down beside James. Patrick joined them, and the three of them cried together for Fitzy.
Day 8, 6th of January, 2015. Chapter 78. 5 a.m, and Lottie stood outside the arrivals door at Dublin Airport, cursing that she had no car. She switched on her phone. 5 missed calls from Kirby. Nothing from Boyd. She tried him first. No answer. Then she rang Kirby.
Jesus, boss! I've been trying to get hold of you for hours, he panted.
What's wrong? My kids, are they all right?
They're fine.
Thank God. Boyd's not answering his phone, and I need a lift home.
He's in hospital.
What? What happened? Is he okay?
Tell me he's okay, Kirby.
No, he's not. Stabbed. Strangled. He's in surgery.
You better get back here.
What the hell happened?
That priest you sent him to talk to is dead. Murdered. Boyd took after the killer and almost got himself killed in the process.
Oh my God, is he going to be okay?
I've no idea.
I'll be there in less than an hour.
And boss?
What?
Superintendent Corrigan is looking for you.
Lottie hung up, ran to the taxi rank and jumped into the first car. Sinking into the seat, she looked out at the grey dawn rising on the horizon, with only one person on her mind. Boyd. The narrow hospital corridor, lined with empty beds and lockers, had staff in green scrubs, unrecognisable as doctors or nurses, flitting along, heads down, scanning patient files. In and out of ICU swinging doors, whooshing wind over the stifling air, they hurried. Lottie was tempted to push open the door to see for herself how serious Boyd was, but rationale ruled. 2 plastic chairs facing the ICU lockdown were free beside a dozing Detective Lynch. Detective Kirby was lounging beside her.
How long since he returned from surgery? Lottie asked.
Half an hour, Kirby said, standing up straight. No word yet.
Lottie paced, then sat.
Let's get a coffee, Lynch said, stretching.
Let's not, Lottie snapped. Calm down, Kirby said.
Tell me exactly what happened.
Lynch filled her in.
And Father Cornelius?
I'm assuming it's the same M.O. as the other murders.
Yes, strangled.
The lads are searching the database to see if he had any connections to the other victims, Lynch said.
I found a connection in Rome.
That's why I rang Boyd to go and talk to the priest, Lottie said.
What did you find?
Lynch asked.
In his interview, Patrick O'Malley mentioned a Father Conn. I found out that Father Cornelius Mohan was a priest in St. Angela's when Sullivan and Brown were there. After that, he was moved around institutions and parishes more times than a carousel. He had to have been a serial child abuser.
But what's the motive for the murders? Kirby asked. And how does a paedophile priest fit in?
He does, somehow. Lottie nursed her head, attempting to keep a headache under wraps. Boy, better make it, she said, and they lapsed into silence. A doctor rushed out of ICU. Lottie sprang from the chair and marched over to him. I'm Detective Inspector Parker. I need to see Detective Sergeant Boyd. I don't care who you are. No one goes in there until he's stable. How long might that be?
As long as it takes.
Doctor, please. I've managed to save his ruptured spleen. He's a very lucky man. No other internal damage that I can see. He'll be in ICU for the rest of the day. I suggest you all go home for now and call back later. Lottie swayed in the draught from the swinging door as the doctor brushed past.
Come on, she said. We can do more for Boyd by finding the murdering bastard who did this to him. This just got personal.
Chapter 79 Kirby dropped Lottie home to pick up her car. Her mother was busy mopping the kitchen floor. Did you ever hear of a Father Cornelius Mohan? Lottie asked, after thanking Rose for looking after the children.
I did.
He lives out in Ballinacloy. Retired this long time. Jesus, her mother really did know everyone. And?
He was a local curate in Ragmullen back in the 70s.
Do you know anything else about him?
Lottie watched her mother's face.
Rose Fitzpatrick stared back.
What's this about? She asked, squeezing out the mop.
Background information. As far as I can recall, he was one of the chaplains in St. Angela's for a time.
Really?
Lottie knew her mother was being evasive.
Come on, Lottie. I've answered your questions about my conversation with Susan Sullivan, and I know you're itching to ask me something else.
Was there ever a hint of scandal surrounding him, especially in St. Angela's? Rose turned, put the mop and bucket into the utility room, grabbed and buttoned her coat. She pulled her hat down over her ears and paused at the door.
I know full well, Lottie Parker, you already know the answer.
And you know full well that's where you dumped Eddie after Dad died, Lottie stated grimly. This was the first time she'd ever accused her mother. Rose's hand dropped from the door handle. She took a step towards Lottie. There were tears in her eyes.
You know as well as I do that your precious father killed himself. He didn't just die.
A sob broke from her throat.
And I didn't dump anyone anywhere.
I'm sorry. Lottie hunched her shoulders, reached out and placed a hand on her mother's shoulder. She waited for Rose to shake it off. She didn't.
No. I'm sorry. You were too young to understand it all. I could never talk about it, and I've always grieved for their loss.
You know about grief. How hard it is to carry on without a husband by your side. I did everything I could to make things right for you.
Everything.
Lottie did know, but she had lived with the gaping hole in her existence every second of the day. Now she wanted answers.
I want to know what happened and why it happened. You owe me that much at least.
Rose pulled away from Lottie's hand and lowered her voice.
After all I've done for you and your children, I don't think I owe you anything.
But why did Dad kill himself?
Lottie persisted.
I don't know.
Okay, I will accept that. For now.
But Eddie, my little brother.
You put him in that place. Left him to rot there. I can't accept that.
You don't know what it was like back then. The stigma attached to suicide. I was a widow with two young children.
And Eddie? He was impossible. I had no choice.
There's always a choice, Mother. You just made the wrong one. Don't judge me, Lottie.
Then tell me why you placed Eddie in there. It was the only place that could handle him.
Lottie laughed wryly. Only they couldn't, could they? He ran away, didn't he?
What must it have been like for him?
She shook herself as the images of the horror of 1970s institutions invaded her senses. Rose shuffled into her coat and walked to the door. I live with what I did every day of my life. And now I'm going. I didn't come here to be interrogated and accused. Goodbye.
Lottie stood bristling for a long time after her mother left. Wrenching her fingers into her hands, she counted the cobwebs woven over the top of the cupboards, took deep breaths, tried to ground herself. How did Rose manage to turn every question into an accusation? She was the one person who could leave her truly shaken. After checking in on Katie, Chloe and Sean, and still in a stupor, stung by her mother's unwillingness to give her the answer she had so long coveted, Lottie changed her clothes, dodged a shower and drove to the station. Her lack of sleep was replaced with adrenaline. She set Kirby and Lynch to work. They needed to keep their minds off Boyd's critical state and find some concrete evidence to advance the murder inquiries. She was convinced the deaths of the two priests, Cornelius and Angelotti, were connected to Susan Sullivan and James Brown, and the common thread was St. Angela's. Uploading the ledger photos from her phone to the computer, Lottie squinted with gritty eyes as the entries appeared on the screen. Each held an untold story. Every name was someone's heartache. And that pain had been suffered in the halls, rooms, and grounds of St. Angela's. She needed access to the building, to get a feel for the place, to discover if it held the answers she wanted.
Print these photos and stick them together chronologically, Lottie told Lynch before heading to the makeshift canteen. She boiled the half-empty kettle. Mug in hand, she turned to find Corrigan framing the doorway.
Not now, she thought.
Morning, sir.
Lottie sipped her coffee as nonchalantly as she could.
You look like shit, Parker.
He folded his arms. No escape. He wasn't going anywhere. She straightened her weary body, raised herself to full height, and mustered up a lame attempt at bravado.
Thank you,
she said, forcing a smile.
I'm not stupid, Corrigan said calmly.
Too calm. She braced herself for the onslaught. I know, she said.
What else could she say?
Don't be smart with me, he said, unfolding his arms.
He leaned in behind her. She flinched and ducked, then noticed he was only switching on the kettle while keeping the exit blocked.
You travel to Rome, he growled.
Yes, sir. No point in denying it.
You disobeyed my direct order. I could suspend you, fire you, have your balls on a plate if you had any.
Yes, sir. Lottie pulled at the sleeve of her shirt, not about to argue with anything he said.
I hope it was worth the trouble you've created, for yourself and everyone else, he said, pouring the dribble of water.
I think it was. Lottie handed him a carton, her nose twitching with the smell of milk ready to turn.
I'm listening, he said,
arms folded again, mug on the counter of boxes.
Okay, sir.
The way I see it, the murders relate back to the incidents which occurred in St. Angela's in the 70s. Possibly a murder, if not two. And yes, I admit I went to Rome. I was following a lead.
What lead might that be?
Father Burke found ledgers with information. He asked me to go take a look. There was no way he could send the information to me.
Go on.
I saw these ledgers detailing children's admissions to St. Angela's. Dates, names, adoptions, deaths. I've yet to analyse the information, and I've no idea of the importance of it,
but the signature on some of the pages is significant.
I'm listening.
Father Cornelius Mohan.
The Ballinacloy victim from last night?
Corrigan asked, unfolding his arms, taking his coffee, spilling it on his shirt sleeve.
Yes, she said. And in another ledger, there are details of his movements, including his stint in St. Angela's.
He moved to over 40 different parishes.
Tells its own story, don't you think? And there he was, living 15 kilometres outside Ragmullen, next door to a primary school. Madness.
All approved by Bishop Connor, who, incidentally, arranged for the ledgers to be moved to Rome.
Lottie watched Corrigan's face as he digested it all.
She added, I contacted Boyd last night, asked him to go to Ballinacloy and interview Cornelius Mohan. I believed he might have information about the victims.
Corrigan's lips hovered over the rim of his mug. I don't believe in coincidences, he said. So how did the killer get to Mohan before Boyd? Was he tipped off?
Not sure, but it's all too convenient, Lottie said. I need to find out who knew we were after the priest. He had to know something that warranted his murder.
Puffing out his cheeks, Corrigan said, I'm giving you a stay of execution. I can't afford to be down another detective with Boyd out. But when this is all over, you may well end up on indiscipline charges in front of the chief superintendent. For now, get back to work. And Parker, he said, drawing his face level with hers.
Yes, sir?
I'll be watching your every move.
His gaze bore tiny holes into the back of her eyes, almost hollowing them out of their sockets, before he walked off, shaking his head.
Lottie sighed. The threat of disciplinary action was now swinging over her head.
But she still had her job.
For now. One positive in a mire of negativity.
Chapter 80. Detective Maria Lynch dropped the copies on the desk.
Lottie picked them up.
Names swarmed in front of her as a thought struck her. Father Joe had allowed her to take the photographs. And he'd been there when she had called Boyd. Her heart plunged a full 2 inches down her chest. He was the only one who knew what she'd told Boyd.
No. Could he have sent someone after the old priest?
He couldn't have. Could he?
She was burning up.
Why did he bring her to Rome, show her all the records, and then double-cross her?
He was her friend, wasn't he?
It didn't make sense.
On the other hand, what other explanation could there be?
Nothing made sense.
She sprang up, as if scalded.
Kirby? She shouted.
He glanced over.
You all right, boss?
Any news from the hospital?
Not yet.
Did we run a check on Father Joe Burke?
She forced her voice to appear normal.
First murder, second person on the scene, Joe Burke?
I'm not in the mood, Kirby.
I'll print it off for you.
His fingers echoed loudly as he stumped up the name on his computer. Clickety-clack, clickety-click. Running her hand along the back of her neck, she didn't know whether she was tracking the memory of Father Joe's fingers or stemming the rise of bile. As Kirby banged away, Lottie heard Tom Ricard before she saw him, the developer's voice thundering abuse at the end of the corridor. The sound, like galvanized sheets loose on a shed roof in a Force 10 gale, preceded his entry to the office. Superintendent Corrigan hung behind him. Lottie swiveled to meet Ricard's dark, raging eyes. The storm just might be upgraded to a hurricane. He crossed the floor to her desk.
Inspector?
Good morning, Mr. Ricard, she said in her sweetest voice. She wheeled over Boyd's chair. Ricard sat, his buttocks precariously balanced on the edge. Nodding to Corrigan that she had everything under control, he scuttled out the door.
Are you here about St. Angela's?
Lottie found a notebook and picked up a pen.
St. Angela's has nothing to do with anything, Ricard said,
a white handkerchief appearing in his hand. He wiped his pulsing forehead. It's my son, Jason. He's missing. Lottie scribbled without raising her head. Katie had said she couldn't get hold of Jason yesterday. She should have listened more carefully. She tried to stem the beginnings of alarm. Surely Jason would at least have contacted Katie. Something wasn't right. Missing. According to Katie, you and Jason had something of an altercation. When was that? Ricard looked as if he was going to object, but said, That's right. Night before last. He stormed out of the house and hasn't been home since. Did you check with his friends, his usual haunts? Yes. And scoured the town, the lake shore, he said. We had a fight. He fecked off. His feet were planted firmly on the ground, but his head shifted from side to side. I understand how worried you are, but Jason is over 18 and an adult. Do you think his disappearance could have anything to do with your St. Angela's dealings? She asked, emphasizing the name of the institution. Ricard shot up from the chair. Lottie recoiled instinctively. You're one callous bitch, he said. Sit down, Mr. Ricard, she said, writing more notes on a page, allowing him time to regain composure. Any ransom calls? What? Ricard clenched his fists on the desk. That's absurd. No ransom requests, then. She wrote a note, then raised her head. Mr. Ricard, I have to ask awkward questions. You're a wealthy businessman. Kidnapping is one option. Suicide or running away are some of the others. If you want us to investigate, you have to cooperate. This was bullshit, but she wasn't letting go. It might be her only chance to get information from him. How can my business affairs have anything to do with Jason? Probably nothing. But the way I see it, you hit your son, he ran off in a huff, and now he's cooling his heels somewhere until he figures out how he's going to tackle you about it. Why isn't he holed up with your daughter, then? Why hasn't he contacted anyone? His phone is at home, but all his friends have mobiles, Facebook and Twitter stuff. Wouldn't he at least contact his girlfriend? What did she tell you? Katie was very frightened when she came home, and she told me you hit your son. She hasn't heard from him since, but Jason is an adult, Mr. Ricard. In normal circumstances, I'd advise you to go home, hold your wife's hand, and wait while we make inquiries. Blood flushed the veins in his cheeks. He remained silent. However, as you know, Lottie continued, things are not normal in Ragmullen at the moment. People have been murdered, so you have cause for concern. She was genuinely concerned for Jason, but she couldn't help being bitchy. She needed to know what Ricard knew. He remained immobile except for his bottom lip twitching as if he wanted to say something but was unable to get the words out. It's not normal procedure, as he's not a minor, and we should really wait a bit longer. But I'll process a missing persons report and put out a bulletin, she said. That's it? A missing persons report? I'm even bending the rules at that. Rules my arse! Where's Corrigan? Ricard stood up. Tell me about St. Angela's, Lottie said, without raising her head. St. Angela's has nothing to do with Jason! He sat down again. Chewing her pen, Lottie tapped her computer awake and pressed a few keys. She clicked Susan Sullivan's pathologist report, scrolled down to the photos, zoomed in on the victim's throat, and turned the screen towards Ricard. She had nothing to lose. What are you playing at? He asked, the handkerchief appearing again. This is our first victim. She was a total shit doing this to him. But being at a low ebb, he might volunteer some useful information. Please, Inspector, don't, he said. Do you honestly think I'd something to do with this? This monstrosity? He puffed out his chest, shaking his head. Lottie closed the document and opened another. James Brown, she eyed Ricard. He phoned you a little while before he died. So tell me. What's going on? Ricard chewed the inside of his cheek. She imagined his brain forming a response. Before he could answer, she said, "Think of your son. Do you want me sitting here in a few days' time scrolling his post-mortem photos for your wife?" He swallowed noisily and leaned in towards her. She waited. "None of this has anything to do with St. Angela's," he said through gritted teeth. "I'm a businessman. I formulate plans, conclude deals, make money, develop property, realize profits. Sometimes I lose, but more often than not, I win. St. Angela's was a site ripe for development, a way of clawing back what I'd lost with the ghost estates. I had a vision for it, a master plan. I wanted to develop it into a beautiful hotel, build a magnificent golf course, bring business, jobs to the town." He straightened his back. "And it has nothing to do with the disappearance of my son." "Just humour me," Lottie said. "You don't give up, do you?"
"Never."
She knew Ricard was considering her, forming a reply he thought she might want to hear. She sat rigid, displaying no emotion. He looked around the room, then back at her, and seemed to come to a decision. "First off, I want you to be clear that I did not murder those people, or arrange for them to be murdered. I had nothing whatsoever to do with those crimes. I might be a lot of things, Inspector, but I am not a murderer."
"Go on," Lottie said.
"Should I have my solicitor present?"
"Depends on whether you've done anything that warrants you needing one."
Ricard exhaled. "James Brown did ring me that evening before he was killed."
"Go on," Lottie repeated.
Nothing new there. They had the evidence.
"I knew both Brown and Susan Sullivan through their work on the planning application. He told me Susan Sullivan was dead, that she might have been murdered. Said he wanted to meet me. That was the sum total of the conversation."
"Why did he contact you?" Lottie asked.
"I don't know. He said he wanted to tell me something urgently."
"Did you meet with him?"
"No. Told him I was busy, hung up.
Then he was killed a few hours later."
"Someone met him and then possibly killed him. Who did you contact after James's phone call to you?"
"No one." "Come on, Mr. Ricard. We can access your phone record."
"I rang my partners to inform them of Sullivan's death and Brown's phone call."
"Your partners? No need for you to know them, is there?"
She would get it out of him later.
"Had any of them reason to kill Sullivan and Brown?"
"How would I know?"
"You must have some idea. What were the victims up to?"
Ricard inhaled a couple of deep breaths.
"Brown and Sullivan. A right pair when they got going," he said. "They knew I'd wrangle the alteration to the county development plan to progress my plans for St. Angela's. Had it in for me. The two of them did. Tried to blackmail me. Said they wanted reparation for past sins or some such shite. I haven't a clue what they were talking about. When Brown first contacted me with their scam back in July, I told him to go fuck himself."
Lottie thought of the money in the victims' bank accounts and the cash in Susan Sullivan's fridge.
"But you gave in."
"I did not." He banged the desk. "I rise above such challenges, Inspector. I don't give in."
"So what did you do?"
"They threatened you with blackmail."
"I convened a meeting with my partners. I told them about the blackmail threats and we decided to ride it out. Brown and Sullivan were not a danger to our plans. They'd no concrete proof of any wrongdoings. In all honesty, there weren't any wrongdoings, just speeding up the planning process."
"And how was that done?"
"A few quid in a few back pockets of councillors."
"But that's not the issue, is it?"
Lottie decided to ignore his admission of planning manipulation. She had enough going on. She decided to change direction. "Were you ever a resident in St. Angela's, Mr. Ricard? As a child?"
"No, I was not. And I don't know what that has to do with anything."
Lottie wasn't sure if this was the truth, but she needed him to confirm it. "Who else is involved in this project?" she asked. If he was telling the truth, and she suspected he was,
who sent the money to the victims' bank accounts. I don't see what you knowing who my partners are has to do with my son's disappearance. You don't know that. I want to know who they are. Will you find my son?
I'll do my best, Lottie said.
Alive? Ricard asked. His bulk appeared to have shrunk since he had entered the room. She didn't answer. That was a promise she couldn't make, however confident she was that the boy had skived off to get away from his overpowering father. She hoped that was the case, thinking of her last missing person, Father Angelotti. He told her the names. Jerry Dunn, Mike O'Brien, Bishop Terence Connor. You need to tell me the whole story, she said, her fatigue from lack of sleep evaporating. There is no story, Inspector. Just a few men pulling a couple of strokes to make a quick buck. Bishop Connor sold me the property below market value in exchange for lifetime membership to the new golf club. Mike O'Brien massaged a few figures so that I could finance the deal, and Jerry Dunn is to ensure the project gets full planning approval. That's it. We're not involved in anything dark enough to warrant murder. I suggest you start looking elsewhere. Otherwise you're wasting valuable time when you could be looking for Jason. Ricard searched his pockets for something. As you appear to have a fascination with St. Angela's, here, take these, he said, slapping a ring of keys on the desk. Go, see for yourself. It's just an old building in need of renovation, bricks and mortar. Satisfy your curiosity. And then for God's sake, find my son. Lottie placed her hand over the keys and pulled them towards her before he changed his mind. Thanks, she said. Go home to your wife. Let me know the second you hear anything from Jason. I'll do likewise. She indicated their interview was over. Ricard stood and without a word or backward glance walked flat-footed out of the office, his tailored suit as wrinkled as his craggy face. Opening the bottom drawer, Lottie extracted the yellowing manila folder and gazed at the young boy in the photograph. She knew exactly what it was like to have someone missing. She hoped against hope that Jason Ricard was only nursing a sore ego. Anything more sinister than that, and they were in a completely new sphere. Chapter 81 Sean Parker listened to Katie sniffling in her bedroom next door. It reminded him of his mother's nighttime crying after his dad had died. The difference was, his mam got up each morning, red-eyed, but in denial, going about her work as if nothing was wrong. He wanted to shout at her, remind her of the crying keeping him awake at night. But he remained silent, his young heart breaking for her, for his sisters and himself. Katie's sobs were different, and he felt sorry for her. He'd been in awe of Jason since he'd let him have a pull on a spliff. He'd managed a few drags before the sitting room swam in a myriad of shapes and colours. Then he vomited for 20 minutes. He hadn't told Jason that. He pressed his camouflage controller and stilled a soldier's action on the screen. He wished his mam was home more. But she had her job and she was busy with the murder investigations. Everyone told him he was the man of the house now that his dad was gone. So what would the man of the house do? He tried to switch off the PlayStation, but it froze. Wouldn't go on or off. He needed a new console, badly, like right now. He had some savings. Searching his locker for his bank card, his fingers touched cold steel and curled around the Swiss Army knife his dad had bought him years ago. He liked to flick open the different shaped blades, pretending he was a character from Grand Theft Auto. In all the years he'd had the knife, he'd never taken it out of the house. Today he would. After all, there was a murderer around. You never knew when he might need a Swiss Army knife. His dad had told him that. He checked the time on his phone. Just gone 11:30. He'd be there and back before lunchtime. He put the bank card in his pocket along with the knife, and pulling on two hoodies, left the house to the sound of Chloe calling Katie a drama queen.
Chapter 82. Kicking off her boots, Lottie massaged her foot with one hand while clutching the keys to St. Angela's with the other. She caught Kirby eyeing her over the top of his monitor.
What?
She asked.
Nothing.
He returned his gaze to the computer.
Kirby, for once in your life, will you say what you're thinking?
Pocketing the keys, she stamped her foot to the floor and shuffled her aching feet back into her boots. Trailing a hand through her limp hair, she took her phone off silent. No messages. No missed calls. No nothing. She hoped Boyd was doing all right. She looked up to find Kirby standing beside her with a page in his hand. He squeezed her shoulder.
You wanted something on Father Burke, he said, and went back to his desk.
Lottie looked at the passport-sized photo of Father Joe, with his boyish fringe and blue eyes, an open and inviting smile. She skimmed the report until her eyes landed on a local newspaper article from Wexford.
Did you read this? She asked.
I did, said Kirby. He appears to be something of a ladies' man.
The words on the page merged into each other. Lack of caffeine or sleep deprivation? She felt like throwing up. Tried to focus, but her mind refused to register what she was looking at. A small article quoting a local woman in Wexford town. She had claimed Father Joe Burke had pursued her, wanting a relationship. She'd ignored his advances, and when he'd persisted, she reported him, but the guards wouldn't do anything about it. Lottie couldn't believe this had actually been printed. Then she thought of the journalist Cahill Moroney and his secret source. She still had to find out who was behind that leak. She raised her head to Kirby.
Chasing after female parishioners, he said, is only a crime in the Catholic Church. There was celibacy and all that. If you ask me...
I didn't, she said, tuning him out. She'd been taken in by Father Joe's good looks and sweet charm. Had he been trying to seduce her when she only wanted friendship? Was that why he insisted she go to Rome when really he could have photographed and emailed the relevant ledger pages? She shoved back her chair, grabbed her phone, and with one arm inside her jacket, was out the door without hearing another word from Kirby. She fully intended to go and have a look around St. Angela's, but as she left the office, she bumped into Maria Lynch at the carpool.
I'm heading back out to Ballinacloy, Lynch said. You coming?
Sure. I'll drive, Lottie said, making up her mind on the spot. St. Angela's could wait. Maybe she might find something at the old priest's abode. Father Cornelius Mohan had lived in a bungalow to the left of the small church. Four cottages, early 20th century, lined the road to the right, a hedged laneway snaking behind. Between the small houses and the church stood a five-class primary school. Thomas the Tank Engine painted on the oil tank. A playground curled around the school. And, for the last 10 years, a paedophile priest had lived next door. All this had been facilitated by none other than Bishop Connor. Lottie shook her head in bewilderment. The Garda, standing at the gate, lifted the crime scene tape, allowing them through. With Lynch talking to the soccos in the yard out the back, Lottie pulled on latex gloves and opened the front door. She surveyed the dark, rambling hallway and entered the kitchen with its high ceiling. Everything was murky brown and the air stank of smoke, turf and cigarettes. A clogged ashtray sat on the table beside a chipped mug half full of stagnant tea. The stove door was open, its ashes as cold as the dead priest. She pushed open another door. A narrow streak of mid-morning glow seeped through at the bottom of thin curtains. As she drew back the cotton, a shaft of brightness illuminating a crest of dust floating in the air threw light on an unmade single bed, a locker, chest of drawers, and a two-door standalone wardrobe. Lifting up a plain blue blanket, Lottie eased gloved fingers under the pillow, felt around and extracted a bulging wallet. It was full of 50 and 100 euro notes. One 500 euro note folded in the back
behind a laminated card of St. Anthony holding the child Jesus. In all, she counted €1,620. Robbery was definitely not Cornelius's murderer's motive. It was evident that the old priest was the only person to have entered this room in a very long time. She opened the drawers, then the wardrobe. Both held a minimal amount of clothing, all of it black, smelling of mothballs and staleness. Kneeling, she looked under the bed. Two pairs of black shoes were lined up with a brown leather suitcase behind them. She dragged out the case, covered with a layer of grime, and unclasped the locks. Yellowed newspaper clippings, folders and notebooks. Lifting up one of the hard-backed notebooks, she opened it. Short pencil strokes neatly aligned on page after page. Figures totted up in columns. Household accounts, she guessed, and picked up another notebook. The same. "Come on, Mohan," she willed. "Give me something." Kneeling on the dusty wooden floor, she flicked through six notebooks, all containing figures. She lined them up beside her and took out the next one. Similar navy hardback. She opened it. No figures. Handwriting. She held her breath. The now familiar pencil, in well-schooled handwriting, a methodical, even structured, script. Words merged and fluttered as she read. A history of abuse, documented in fading pencil, fell from the pages, letter by letter, word by word, floating around her, an incomprehensible pile of sentences. It wasn't enough, she thought, that he'd perpetrated such acts on the innocent. He'd also recorded it. A chronicle of secrets, inscribed with fading pencil, in a navy blue hardback notebook, incarcerated in the brown leather suitcase of a murdered, child-abusing priest. It assaulted her very soul. She felt her heart break and harden at the same time. Unable to finish reading, she placed the notebook in a plastic evidence bag and shoved it into her inside jacket pocket. It didn't matter where she placed it. She knew she'd never be able to expunge the horror inscribed by the hand of a demon. He must not have thought about what would happen to these notebooks when he died. Otherwise, he would have got rid of them. Unless he had used them to revisit his crimes. What kind of sadistic animal had he been? She called for Lynch, okayed it with the Soco team and carried the suitcase to the car. She fled the house, unable to shake off the sound of soft footsteps belonging to little abused children trailing behind her. The bell in the small country church chimed, and the village resonated with the hollow midday toll. Chapter 83. The queue outside the bank ATM seemed to go on forever. Sean stamped his feet in the snow and decided to take his chances inside. At least it was warmer there. He waited in line for a machine to become available. The woman in front of him, struggling with the toddler and a screaming baby in a buggy, eventually got her money. He keyed in his PIN number and extracted €200. That should be enough, he thought, knowing he hadn't much left now. He could trade in his old PlayStation for the balance. He wondered where Jason could be. He decided he would ask his own friends if any of them had seen him. Not that his friends mixed with the likes of Jason Ricard. But you never know until you ask. He stuffed the money into his trouser pocket and headed for the door. The man watched the boy. Running his hands up and down his suited trousers, he glanced around to ensure no one noticed him. He recognized the young teenager, Detective Inspector Parker's only son. He stepped behind a rack of leaflets. The stirring in his trousers was so intense, he stuffed his hands in his pockets to quell the rising hardness. It was too risky. He already had one boy. But if he truly wanted to reenact the old experience, he needed two, didn't he? As the boy pushed the green button on the internal security door, the man moved quickly to get in line behind him. When the door opened, he entered the small enclosure and smiled. The boy grinned back. Chapter 84. The noon sky was dark, more like late afternoon, and it was snowing once again. Leaving the village of Balnacloy, Lottie checked to see if there was any word from the hospital. Nothing. At the station, she accompanied Lynch inside with the suitcase. They registered the contents, and Lottie flicked through the old notebook once more. She recoiled from the written horrors and bagged the book for evidence. "I'll be back in a while," she said. Badly in need of a shower, she picked up her own car. She also wanted to visit Boyd. But first stop, now that she had the keys, would be St. Angela's. A sore throat was itching to take root. Lottie coughed and it ached even more. Standing at her car, looking up at the old building, she needed to ease the stress constricting her brain. She counted the windows once, then twice. Careful not to slip on the fresh sheen of snow, she walked up the steps. At the door, key in hand, she had an uncharacteristic surge of dread. She was fearful for herself, her past, her decisions, her attitude, her grief and what she was becoming. In an instant, she wished Boyd was with her, jibing her. She missed him. Slipping latex gloves over numb fingers, she turned the key in the old lock and pushed open the door, surprised it extended inwards with comparative ease. The entrance hall was smaller than she expected. An icy chill took her breath away, colder inside than out. She half expected to see water running down the walls from burst pipes. Before her stood a large staircase. The mahogany banisters twisted upwards, enclosing wide concrete steps leading to a crossroad of dark corridors. She didn't bother with the light switch. It might not work and she didn't want to find out. Sometimes you are better off not knowing, rather than finding yourself literally in the dark. She comforted herself with that thought. She listened. Stillness inside, while the wind outside hurled snow against the window panes, rattling their frames. A draft rustled dead leaves at her feet. She closed the front door and kicked the remnants of snow from her boots. She decided to check out the upper floors. At the top of the first flight of stairs, she moved along a corridor lined on one side with doors and windows on the other. Subconsciously, she counted the windows, couldn't help it, and mentally filed the numbers away. Doubling back, she headed along the other corridor, counting these windows. Their frames creaked, then settled. She repeated the exercise on the other floor, counting. It didn't add up. She ran down the stairs, counted again. Only 13 windows. 16 on the outside. Both ends of the corridor were bookended by concrete. She traced her hand along the wall and knocked intermittently, wondering if they were hollow. They appeared solid. Perhaps Tom Ricard could provide the answer. She was curious about the inaccuracy, but had no idea what significance it might have, if any. A bird shrieked above her head, its wings crashing against the wooden rafters, and disappeared. She would have screamed if her throat wasn't already raw. She leaned against the wall and felt the vibes of the past. O'Malley's story reverberated in her brain. The clamour of children running along corridors, nuns screaming behind them, hair pulling, squealing, jaws clattering with the backs of wizened hands. The image was so vivid, if she reached out, Lottie thought she might touch it. The anguish, the loneliness of abandoned children. There was no sense of dreams or expectations. It was all despair and loss. Once again, her thoughts were invaded by the image of the yellowing file in her bottom desk drawer. The missing. The dead. The young red-headed boy. Had he been murdered? Or had O'Malley's drink-addled brain conjured up a myth? She recalled the words scripted in the Navy hardback notebook and the ledgers full of truths